Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast show on the New Books Network. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today I'm speaking with Philip Cunliffe, author of the book The New 20 Years Crisis, a critique of international relations, 1999 to 2019. Philip, welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, Mark, and thanks for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, we're delighted to have you on our podcast. I was wondering if you could start us off by telling our listeners something about yourself.
Yeah, so I'm an academic in Britain at the University of Kent, where I've worked for just over 10 years now. And so I finished my doctorate just over 10 years ago as well. And in that time, I suppose my concerns over the last 10 years or so have been thinking about different aspects of liberal international order. A lot of it concerned with the dynamics of sovereignty and military intervention, peacekeeping in particular, the role of the United Nations in conflict management. These are the things that have been my preoccupation for the last 10 years. And it's more recently with this book, for instance, that I've tried to scale up some of these insights into broader accounts of international politics and to provide a broader outlook on the dynamics of the liberal international order and debates around it as well.
It's a very interesting book, and it's one that ties into a very famous work by I think his name is Edward Hallett-Carr, where he talked about the 20 Years Crisis, a book that came out on the eve of the Second World War. What was it that led you to, you know, make the decision to make that leap now? And why did you choose Carr's work as your springboard or your template?
So it was when the book was conceived a couple of years ago, well, or even less perhaps even something like 18 months ago, because it was written in a kind of period of particular intensity, and how far it benefits from that intensity of the moment with everything that has happened in global politics over the last few years, including here in Britain with Brexit, is up for the reader to judge. But it was on the eve of 2019, which was the 80th anniversary of the publication of Carr's book that you mentioned, The 20 Years Crisis. And it's, for a long time, it's been taken as a foundational work in the discipline of international relations. And it concerns, it's Carr's critique, as he styles it, his realist critique of liberal utopianism, of liberal idealism, of the interwar period, and how the liberal international order crumbled in the interwar period. And so it has this totemic status within the discipline, as not only accounting for the failures of liberal international order in that period and how that leads to the Second World War, but also as inaugurating what was called the First Great Debate. So the first debate within the discipline over some basic foundational questions as to what kind of response is adequate to understanding international politics and whether that should be focused on questions of state power, state interest and the conflict for power between states, or whether that should be focused on efforts to produce international cooperation at the level of international organization and international law. And Carr famously, notoriously plumped for the former, that it should be firmly that the discipline The infant science, as he called it, of international politics should be firmly focused on the competition for power between states and how this shapes not only actual political outcomes and dynamics, but also how it conditions all of our frameworks. So given the intensity of debates on liberal international order in the last few years, connected to growing geopolitical rivalry between the US and China, the election of Donald Trump and his efforts to restructure America's alliances around the world, his critique of liberal internationalism and how it is, according to him, how it has undermined America's status, allowed allies to free ride on America's generosity. All of these issues that arose in the last few years seem to, they all raised again the debates over liberal international order. And it was in that context that I thought it would be worth returning to an iconic text and using the optics provided by E.H. Carr to see how far they still applied to our own contemporary crisis of liberal international order. And the reason I chose Carr was it wasn't just because of the iconic status of his text, or the fact that it was an anniversary year for the publication of Carr's work, but also because he himself, I think, had been overlooked. So there have been plenty of realist criticisms of liberal international order in the last few years, and particularly coming from US-based academics and analysts, people like Stephen M. Welt or John G. Mearsheimer at Chicago, or Andrew Bacevich, the strategic theorist and military historian who's at Boston. And they've all provided tremendously incisive and cutting analyses of the failures of US nation building, the failures of US grand strategy, what they call liberal hegemony in the foreign policy of the US that has led to perpetual war in the Middle East and the US being embroiled in all of these conflicts from Libya to Afghanistan and further afield even. And so there have been plenty of criticisms drawing on US-based accounts of international order. And so with Carr, I explicitly wanted to bring into the picture a British realist thinker, and also to bring into the picture his specific criticisms of European liberalism, of European politics, and to draw on the patrimony, I suppose, of British international relations thought, because it seemed to me important to broaden out the debate beyond the critique of US foreign policy, essentially, and US grand strategy, to understand the dynamics of international order in a broader vein. And I thought that Carr would allow me to do that.
I really like what you mentioned about a moment ago about how Carr is sort of this founding figure in international relations, because as you explain in your book, you're not just, you know, offering a critique of the liberal international order and where it is at this point in time, but you're also examining the discipline itself and the way which is steered so far afield of this that it has, in effect, you know, mirrors a lot of the same mistakes and woolly thinking that you have seen in a lot of international relations practice that you're talking about in terms of the liberal order and utopianism.
Yeah, absolutely. And so this is the other element that I wanted to pursue in the book. So like I say, like some of these American realists and American analysts have been very cutting in exposing the naivety and the idealism and the sheer dogmatism of liberal foreign policy based around democratization, human rights, humanitarian intervention, nation building, these kinds of shibboleths that have dominated American foreign policy for so long. But there, I wanted to expand it to go beyond just the limits of liberal foreign policy, but also to consider international relations theories more broadly. And so I extend them to, or I extend the critique to look at constructivist theories and critical theories of international relations, because I think some of the maladies of our, or limits of our thinking, and particularly the utopian elements of those, as identified by Carr, have been replicated in these new theories, which kind of they've grown up in the last 30 years since the end of the Cold War. And in that context, these new kind of theories of international politics, constructivism and critical theories, have tended to emphasize the malleability of politics and social life. as the name suggests, constructivism, that we can construct our world, we can reconstruct the world order should we so choose. So the emphasis on agency, on voluntarism, on plasticity, I think it expressed the kind of the hopes and the aspirations of a world which seemed to be far more open to reshaping in the aftermath of the Cold War, that the world looked as if it was it could be changed, that there was scope to reshape it in profound and lasting ways that would make it more pleasant and hospitable and benevolent ultimately. And so those theories, I think, have they've fed directly into some of the conceits and the idealism and the blindsidedness of international politics. This emphasis on the fundamental, like I say, the plasticity of politics, I think was vastly overstated. And what I think Carr allows us to do, and what I try to do in the book, is that he draws attention to the link between power and the structure of theoretical insight. And I think that's paralleled, or we can see this, in the character of the theories that have dominated in international relations for the last 30 years or so, and this distribution of power in the international order. And so I make the claim in the book that the rise to prominence, particularly of constructivist thinking in the discipline, it reflects a unipolar world. It reflects the conceit of a world in which so much power is concentrated in one center, in the West, and in particular in the US, it came to be seen that it was possible to profoundly reshape the entire world, and that there would be no consequences or ramifications for the balance of power, that there was no limit essentially to how far power could reach, but that there was no consciousness of this at the same time. So because the theories were constructed in such a way that they believed that they were analyzing, they were adopting a new set of lenses, which means that they saw the world in an entirely new way, and they became entirely disconnected from underlying questions of power, state interest, and basic questions of politics, that it always involves the competition for power, that it always involves competition between states, that it always involves a clash of differing interests. And all of these very basic insights that you think would be apparent to scholars of world politics have all been lost, I think, as the result of the elevation of these theories that emphasize human agency and that emphasize the fundamental malleability of politics. And so I hope that Carr allows us to draw attention to the character of theories and the kind of the shape and form that particular theories take, and the underlying distribution and character of power in international politics. And it seems to me there is a connection, that we can see the connection in the last 30 years. And it's essentially the emphasis in these theories on the capacity to change the world. I think that reflects a world in which there was seen to be no limit to the power of the West and to the power of the U.S. in particular.
I like that critique you make in your introduction, where you're talking about how so much of the theory has ignored what you've just described, so long as they're right on particular issues. And the one you focus on is the Iraq War in 2003. And I especially like the phrase, the great alibi. It's because they were against the Iraq War that therefore that it, there's nothing wrong with the approach. It's about how you apply it. And so they're not really considering too deeply some of the fundamental mistaken assumptions or mistaken approaches that have caused them to lose sight of what you've described in terms of the realism of state interaction and state power.
Yeah. And I mean, you can probably count supporters of the Iraq War in the discipline, at least, outside of the kind of the neocon circles around the George Bush presidency of the time. I mean, you could count the supporters of the Iraq War in the discipline maybe on the fingers of one hand, I'd say, everybody opposed it. But at the same time, everyone like you mentioned, it became the alibi for being essentially for morally claiming the moral high ground in opposing this deeply unpopular military intervention, but then having the credit at the same time to ignore all the other kind of very similar episodes of military intervention that seemed to, that built on Iraq or mirrored what happened in Iraq, most notably Libya. but also that there was no examination or no willingness to take the consequences or implications of what Iraq actually manifested. And I mean, it's very striking in terms of how, and this is what I try to do in the book, is to compare how international relations as a set of theories and as a discipline has failed to either to take the intellectual initiative in terms of being able to discern what Iraq meant for the future of world politics, and also how it's failed to adapt to the changes in world order when compared to political science or to the discipline of economics, where I think for all their flaws, both of these other branches of academic investigation, of scholarly investigation, have adapted better to the dramatic changes in world politics, in national politics over the last few years than international relations. And this is despite the fact that we should have had longer to do it, given that the war in Iraq has been, you know, continuous since 2003, at least, if not indeed since the early 1990s. And some of the things that I think Iraq, if we'd been attentive, instead of kind of morally distancing, you know, kind of claiming the moral virtue of being opposed to the war, instead of simply doing that, but if we'd been attentive to some of the surrounding politics of the Iraq war, I think it would have led us to deeper insights about the direction in which politics in the region and in the world was headed. Mm-hmm. So some of the examples I mentioned were, for instance, the inability of the US to really build a firm alliance around the military intervention. Not only did, you know, they fail to take the UN Security Council, but they failed to get, say, Turkey to allow, famously, to allow US troops to advance into Iraq from the north. They ended up, you know, supposedly a war that was waged for the benefit of U.S. oil corporations, which was a widespread criticism at the time, not only in, you know, not only kind of in popular debate, but also in academic debate. And it's ended up, in fact, that it's Chinese oil companies that have kind of encroached on Iraqi oil fields and that seem to have benefited more than U.S. oil corporations. The fact that the U.S. engaged in a war on terror, this kind of omnidirectional, limitless war, with inflated, you know, expanding its military spending, expanding its commitments at the same time as the Bush administration of the day was ramming through tax cuts, as well as not seeking, you know, as well as refusing to mobilize or rally U.S. society to the kind of collective effort that one would think would be necessitated by an omnidirectional war with which was unlimited in time and space. And instead, you know, they ended up kind of relying on redeploying the same reservists over and over again. And so I think, you know, this stored up problems, not only in terms of the problems of U.S. Debt and problems of for the U.S. economy, but also just in terms of, say, military families and the war weariness of the U.S. population, and how that has fed into support for and even indeed the election of Donald Trump, one of the most highly correlated factors of voting for Donald Trump in 2016, where families, military families who had had veterans and had relatives deploying abroad on repeat tours, and they were deeply disenchanted and wary of the liberal interventionism which had put the U.S. in permanent kind of military deployment for the last 20 years. So all of this is to say that we should have been further ahead than we were, and we have no excuses. And Iraq, instead of the invasion of Iraq giving us the opportunity to discern the pattern of politics as it would unfold, which is to say the politics we've been through for the last few years, instead it became the excuse to kind of wash our hands of having to undertake any further analysis and to step back. And that's why I call it the great alibi.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I'd like to take a step back and talk a bit about the liberal international order that you describe as and situate in the the 1990s. What was it in general terms, and how did it fail? In we've already talked about the particular of, say, the Iraq War. We've talked about Libya. You mentioned Mali, Syria. But what broadly were the errors at work that are the connecting factor in all of these different conflict areas, and how do they those factors reflect that failure?
So I date our 20-year crisis across the period 1999 to 2019, in which I think you see the, which is to say, analogously to Carr's interwar crisis between 1919 and 1939. When Carr kind of framed it in that way, he meant to say that the problems that were emerging in the 1930s, or that fully had erupted by the late 1930s, that the seeds of those problems were sown in the aftermath of the First World War. So they were sown in 1919. And this is what made it a kind of integrated crisis of a peace. And so I wanted to make the same claim in saying that in 1999 to 2019, the seeds were sown, the seeds of our contemporary problems were sown in 1999, which is to say, in the peak of the post-Cold War period. And there are two events in particular, which I think justify the identification of 1999 as a turning point. The first is the Kosovo War. So the NATO bombing of what was then Yugoslavia, to halt the Serbian counterinsurgency campaign in the breakaway province of what was then the breakaway province of Kosovo. And the NATO bombing was important in also, I mean, it was a high point of the liberal humanitarianism of that particular period. It was a war which was justified in the most kind of grandiloquent and sweeping terms as a war for civilization itself, and was explicitly a war for human rights, ending dictatorship, genocide, and ending human suffering. And it also went ahead without the imprimatur of the UN Security Council. And so it set the stage for a restructuring of the way in which we view sovereignty and intervention and human rights, and in which the rights of states to non-intervention were dramatically curtailed in the wake of the Kosovo conflict. The other thing that was particularly so important, and in the way in which it also helped set the stage for Iraq, was the fact that there was no support from the United Nations, so that it was a war that was conducted in the face of the opposition of the UN, because the Chinese and Russians threatened to veto it in the UN Security Council. And that, again, set the stage for Iraq. So it laid the ground for a greater willingness to wage war for liberal purposes, to restructure the international order according to liberal precepts of defending human rights, elevating the rights of individuals over the rights of sovereign states, laying the groundwork for the expansion of democracy and generally expanding the liberal idealism and all of that that came in the afterglow of the end of the Cold War. And that story, that story is fairly familiar, and it matches with many accounts of the overextension of liberal idealism and what other authors have called liberal hegemony. The second element, which I think is overlooked, but I want to insist is equally important, if not perhaps even more important in 1999, is the emergence of the euro. So it's when the euro was launched on international financial markets. So when when several different currencies in Western Europe were united into a single currency zone, but without a monetary union, without a fiscal union. And this laid the ground for the debt crisis that would emerge in the aftermath of the global financial crash of 2008, and would then and still continues to roil the European Union and the Eurozone right to this day. And the significance of that is that the I want to insist that the attempt to build a monetary union without a fiscal union or a political union in Europe is, even if it is not as ostentatiously violent and bloody as the destruction of Libya or Iraq or intervention or for the forever war in Afghanistan, it is nonetheless a monument to liberal utopian folly. The attempt to build a, you know, the attempt to build this kind of new order without the actual, without attention to the actual hard political questions of sovereignty, of identity, of state power. I think it speaks to a folly which in many ways is even greater than the idea that the US was going to build a functioning liberal democracy in Afghanistan, or that Iraq would be the beginning of a wave of democratic renewal and revitalization across the whole Middle East. You know, those, I mean, everyone sees those as follies, but I think we forget that there is an even, perhaps an even greater folly, and perhaps less bloody, but no less ultimately destructive, in the attempt to build the Eurozone and the devastating effects of that across, and particularly across the southern tier of the Eurozone, the debt-prone economies of the Mediterranean countries. I mean, it is difficult to understate how calamitous the effect of the Eurozone has been. So to give one example, which was given by a historian, I mean, if you saw the kind of unemployment rate, say, in a state of the US that you had seen in Spain, for instance, during the heyday of the Eurozone debt crisis, in all likelihood, a governor in the US would have called the national, would have called the, sorry, would have called the state level emergency. But there was nothing, there was simply no capacity to resolve those issues in the Eurozone the way that there is in the US, because the US is a single country, whereas the Eurozone is, like I say, a monetary union without an actual fiscal union, and without the capacity to redistribute resources from a single center, or to call upon the kind of centralized aid that is available in the US and that allows for the capacity to buffer economic shocks that on the scale that the Eurozone saw. So it's a, to get back to your question, those are the two events that emerge in 1999, the Kosovo War and the establishment of the Eurozone, which grows over the period of the 20 years crisis as I lay it out, and that these crises then, I think, kind of work their way through until 2019, that we're now stuck in a that the European Union is essentially immobilized financially and economically, still caught in the trap which was laid for it through its construction of the Eurozone. And with Kosovo, we see that the forever war and the permanent war is the legacy of the NATO intervention in Kosovo. And I should add also, just quickly to add to that, it's not just obviously permanent war isn't just the US in Afghanistan, but also the French in Mali, and the French indeed across Northwest Africa. So there is an equivalent kind of permanent, an equivalent forever war happening there that is the product of liberal interventionism and of the same kind of liberal idealism and the same kind of hopes for re-democratizing entire regions. And all of that is a consequence of this of these failed strategies. So it's not restricted. These problems are not restricted to the short-sightedness of U.S. foreign policy. They are problems that are much more pathological and much more deeply embedded in Western politics and Western foreign policy than just a failure or a lapse of U.S. grand strategy or political vision.
I think you make that point very well across your entire book. Then in your third chapter, you focus more specifically upon the European example. And I'd like to take a few moments to elaborate upon some of what you're talking about. The, as you put it very nicely, the utopian ideal of what the EU was supposed to represent and what it doesn't. And also the degree to which those failures are back in the late 1990s with not just the euro, but a lot of the assumptions that subsequently went along with that have, you know, had played their own share in terms of the 20 years crisis, which, as you frame it, if I may, you know, draw back from this, some of the earlier chapters, really breaks down to this notion of almost like a contrast or a conflict between sovereignty and governance, between the notion of the people's will, which is we nowadays see expressed in terms of, say, Brexit, the National Front in France, what you saw in Greece at the height of the Eurozone crisis, and you know, the notion of you know, the you know, Brusselscrats or the Eurocrats in Brussels, you know, basically governing however they see fit with very little concern about accountability to any sort of elected body whatsoever.
Yeah. And the what is particularly striking about this is the fact that it vindicates so much of Kahn's analysis from the interwar period. So Kahn made the case in the interwar period that with the liberal international order was effectively a projection of U.S. Kind of U.S. naivety. Under Woodrow Wilson, and it was projected into the war, kind of the devastated and war-weary continent of Europe, from a country that had been so fortunate in terms of the 19th century. The US had expanded enormously economically, politically, geographically, and therefore it had no inkling of the kinds of difficulties and tensions that European states found themselves in. And in particular, what Kahr says is that the liberal politics was unable to withstand the incursions of mass politics. So the expansion of the franchise, the incorporation of working class and urban voters into political systems of this period, the attempt to incorporate the masses into politics, the reduction of property franchises for voting rights, all of this is simply incapable of being absorbed within liberal international politics. And this is what, for him, made the case for a different kind of model, the incompatibility between the regulations and restrictions of liberal international politics with the demands of mass national politics. And so what's striking about the European Union is that it has been explicitly constructed through evacuating mass politics. So evacuating the demands of mass national politics from the way in which the European Union conducts itself. And so what I mean by that is that the whole purpose of the European Union is to insulate core areas of, I mean, central political questions from the influence of democratic politics. And it does this, obviously, by extracting them from the domestic arena and insulating them at the supranational level. So if we compare, so one element that I pick up on, for instance, if we think of the Supreme Court, which is one of the least democratic elements of the US political system, it's nonetheless envisioned as part of a series of checks and balances that are integrated into a single political system. Whereas the equivalent body in the European Union, the European Court of Justice, which is a deeply, conservative court with respect to, say, clashes between labor and capital, it routinely finds in favor of corporations and bosses at the expense of labor. But the European equivalent of the ECJ, the European Court of Justice, it's not integrated as part of a single political system. There is no way to override it. It is complete supreme authority over the member states of the European Union, and it is not part of a single coherent polity, because the kind of the other bodies of the European Union are not designed to function as part of an integrated political system. They're designed to keep politics or political decision making, core areas of policy, away from contamination by mass politics. At a supranational level, so taken away extracted from domestic level politics. And so what you have effectively is the reverse of what Kahr diagnosed in the interwar period, that the European Union has been successfully built, this utopian, as I style it, this kind of utopian harmony of interests in which governments and elites across Europe have constructed this tremendously, in one sense, a tremendously impressive edifice of international cooperation, but it's been built at the cost of being insulated from national politics, from mass politics, and from democratic legitimization. And this is what roils European politics at the moment. The disconnect, the profound lack of democratic legitimacy of all of these structures of cooperation. And as I say, they are a remarkable vindication of Carr's analysis that the liberal international politics of the European Union has only been sustained by keeping mass national politics at bay, by keeping democratic politics at bay. And this is still remains the central issue of the European Union, the lack of legitimation, the lack of democratic legitimation, and the lack of any single political identity within which liberal politics in Europe can be sustained.
You conclude your book by talking about the, you know, the next, what goes on beyond this. I was wondering if you could perhaps offer first what some of the conclusions you've reached after having explained these issues, and where you see both the international relations going could potentially be like, you know, if these trends are continue, and also how your discipline could respond more effectively to these issues and perhaps offer us a better understanding of these problems and how we might be able to solve them.
So I suppose the what I try to do in the book is not just to apply the Carrian framework and his critique of utopian idealism and the political infantilism and naivety of which he's so scathing, but also to try and go beyond the Carrian framework, which is to say that the very fact that we have been through these repeat cycles of liberal fragmentation, decline, and collapse, and then kind of political restructuring, suggests to me that to a certain extent we live, you know, there's that we, these are built into our ideological frameworks and our institutional frameworks, this terror of political change and this fear that liberal, that the collapse of liberal institutions and that the collapse of liberal politics will inevitably tip us into the maelstrom of catastrophe, of international war, of the disintegration of international order, and ultimately fascism and world war and chaos and conflict. And so I think the very, you know, this, the sense that we perpetually inhabit an interregnum between world wars, the sense that any kind of change to liberal international order will inevitably result in this kind of complete chaos, I think that is also the fear, that is also something that we have to get beyond. And so the fact that we've been through a cycle of a 20-year cycle of political, of the decline of liberal international order, and now it's restructuring over the last few years, and the fact that that hasn't resulted in world war, I think, you know, that's something from which we should draw solace, but also draw the right conclusion, which is, to my mind, that we should not be allow ourselves to live in fear of the patterns and cycles of the 20th century. Now, we should be willing to restructure the inherited institutions and practices and norms of 20th century politics without fear that this will inevitably pitch us into chaos and cataclysm and world war and dictatorship and genocide and the rest of it. So I think that would be that's what I try to put across in the book, in the concluding part of the book, is that the very fact that we've managed to, that these cyclical patterns of liberal fragmentation and decline occur across, not only in the most recent kind of 20 years crisis, but across the course of the 20th century as well, that suggests to me that we shouldn't be afraid to seek to mount more ambitious visions of political change, that we can afford to do that. And that in order to kind of, in order to escape this universe in which we're constantly, we feel like we're constantly on the brink of this terrible calamity, that if we're to ever escape that, then we have to be willing to mount more fundamental projects of political transformation than we've seen so far. And indeed to go beyond the moderate restraint that is often offered up in liberal institutions and in terms of liberal visions of politics. And with regard to the second part of your question as to how that might affect the discipline of international relations, I make the case that we're emerging into a world in which there is more power political competition. And this is reflected in the, you know, relative diminution of U.S. power. So it's obviously not to suggest that the U.S. is in kind of any terminal decline or anything as dramatic or overblown as that. But it would be, I think it's legitimate to say that relative to other states, and in particular relative to China, that the margin of U.S. supremacy has been eroded. And that as a result of this, we will end up in a world in which there are more checks and limits to what the U.S. is capable of in terms of international politics, more checks on U.S. power. And correspondingly, I think, more power political competition than we're used to seeing. I would like to hope that that will focus minds and that will cut away from some of the more kind of exotic and baroque forms of international relations theorizing that we've seen in the last few years that have kind of overgrown the basic features of international political life and made it so difficult to actually identify the most important kind of political questions. Whether or not that happens, I'm not sure, because I think there is there's always an institutional lag in the academy between changes in the outside world and the way in which academic disciplines restructure themselves in order to respond to those changes. But also that the way in which international relations has completely lost any sense of intellectual proportion or limit or any sense of coherence in the way in which it thinks about international politics. That is, I think, I fear it's very deeply rooted and it will take a long time before it's capable of addressing the world of international politics with greater lucidity and insight, because that's been sorely lacking, I think, for the last 20 years.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Yeah, sure. So at the moment, I'm trying to think through the consequences or the viability of certain kinds of liberal conflict management in a world in which we have more geopolitical rivalry. And this is particularly with respect to United Nations peacekeeping. So I'm essentially UN peacekeeping grew up in the, it emerged in the Cold War era of bipolarity. It's boomed in the era of unipolarity, and it's an important and overlooked part of liberal international order. It has allowed nation building and all sorts of grand experiments in liberal engineering in post-conflict countries to take place with very little account of the costs in terms of blood and treasure, or in terms indeed of the what are the actual kind of political consequences and implications of these nation-building experiments. So it's boomed in the era of unipolarity, and what I'm trying to analyze is what will happen to these conflict management practices in a world in which it might be a bipolar world between US and China, or a multipolar world in which there's even more kind of competition for power, say, perhaps between the US, China, Russia, India, and maybe others as well. So I'm trying to think about what conflict management looks like in a world in which there is far more profound competition and geopolitical rivalry than we've seen for a long time.
Sounds like a very worthy compliment to, you're basically practicing what you preach in terms of making something that applies to the very real world in which we seem to be developing into.
I hope so. And I also hope that it would also provide, again, and also lead to new insights about perhaps new ways to do things as well, and new institutions, and that we don't need to feel committed to trying to perpetuate liberal institutions of one period and trying to prolong their life artificially in a profoundly different era.
Well, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us, Philip. I hope you have a wonderful day.
Thank you very much.